Well, welcome. The bells and the gongs and all have struck. We welcome you to the last of a stanza examinations. And what we wanted to begin things with today is just again an invitation to have you ask any questions that are lingering that might be useful to take a look at. By now, if you don't know that in this building and anywhere where there's theosophy is able to fill the atmosphere, there are no such things as stupid questions. So you know that by now, I'm sure. So there's something that you'd like to raise as we get into the...
I've been troubled by something that's come up several times in the reading that we've never talked about. Her comments about different portions of modern humanity, where she talks about the civilized versus the savage. Several places, it seems to me, like one reading of her meaning could give a lot of ammunition to those who want to use as slaves or take advantage of these aboriginal people because they have reason to say that they are of lower quality than we are. Do you have a comment on that? It was disturbing to me because in reading these things, I felt like she was saying that there were a lot more significant differences here between different parts of modern humanity.
No, I think that what you're pointing to is certainly there. The question is, how does one evaluate it? How does one regard it? What does one do about it? Here I can only tell you my own view on the subject. And I cannot guarantee this was HPV's view. One of the things I think you need to keep in mind always in reading about a subject like this, whether in HPB or elsewhere, or in reading about any subject in writings produced more than 100 years ago, is that there tends to be a difference of sensibilities about all sorts of things. And the general sensibilities in the culture inevitably affect how the individual thinks and talks about matters. That is just inescapable. I can give you some we'll get back to the specific item, because I think it's, but you don't mind if I diverge a little before to show this is not, the question you have raised is not in fact limited to that specific question. It's really, that's an example of a much, I think, broader, wider kind of thing. An example I will give, which is both much more recent and rather different, has to do with what it is taboo to talk about, or to joke about, or to make derogatory references about. This changes, and in fact has changed during the lifetime of several of us in this room. When I was a youngster, one simply did not talk about certain sexual matters. They were just very taboo. Not that they didn't exist. Not that everybody didn't know they existed. But you didn't talk about them. It just wasn't done. And similarly, certain religious matters, you were very careful how you talked about them. Sex and religion were the two great taboos in language. Neither one is especially tabooed today. Our sense of what is unspeakable has changed considerably. I wish I could give you examples, but I can't, because I'm a product of my past. I couldn't possibly say some words I'm thinking of at the moment. But all of you know what they are, right? That are now relatively common. But what has become taboo in our time are racial terms, racial and ethnic terms. They have replaced them. And this, I'm not just making this up, this is clear in dictionaries. Lexicography, dictionary making, is one of the things which I have professionally been concerned with much of my adult life. Not on a practical level, I don't do anything that's practical, but on a theoretical level. But that is striking in the last 25 years. Well, I can remember when some of the so-called four-letter words were first entered in dictionaries. They were not, none of them were in dictionaries. You couldn't find them, right? They were simply not there. Now, a dictionary supposedly lists every word in the English language. I mean, that's what a dictionary is for. But the sexual terms, they could not list. The first dictionary, this would be getting too digressive, but the first dictionary to begin to list the four-letter words was the American Heritage Dictionary, which oddly enough was published because they thought that the Merriam-Webster Third New International was too radical. So they came out with a more conservative dictionary. But if you're going to have a conservative dictionary, you have to have something to sell it. So they put in the naughty words, and that broke the floodgates. And after that, every dictionary had them. But now the words which are taboo, and these I can say because I come out of a background where they did not have the strong taboo which they've got on the nigger, kike, right? Words like that. About 2 years ago, a great campaign was launched by someone in this country that you wouldn't know the name, so it's not important. In effect, to get dictionaries not to include words like nigger in them, because they are bad words. That is to say, nigger, kike, etc., replaced the old sexual terms. Shouldn't be in dictionaries, right? This is simply historical fact. But that historical fact reflects a very interesting change in our sensibility towards language. Adele, my wife, likes to read old novels. And the novels of the 1920s, she's often pointing out to me, have these casual ethnic insults or jokes in them that could not possibly be put into a contemporary fiction, right? Utterly taboo. Can't be done. And they were just passed off. Nobody thought anything about them. Now, I'm only saying this to point out that sensibilities change over a period of time. And the people who, the writers, and these were often very good writers, good both in terms of style and I think in terms of their personal worth. They were good people who wrote these. But they didn't think anything about using these terms. Because the culture of the time didn't taboo them. Now, my point in telling you this is that when you read anything from the past, written in the past, I think you always have to put yourself into the frame of mind of the culture at that period. Because if we judge it by our own sensibilities, we are going to be misjudging it, i.e. we're going to be projecting back on that time and that writer intentions that weren't there because they simply weren't conscious. Do you all understand what I'm saying? And I can give you, and there are so many examples of this, just in general terms, that I have to suppress them. Very quick one, which is now related to sex. And not to ethnic matters. Lewis Carroll, or Charles Lutwidge Dodgson, as his real name was, you know, the author of Alice in Wonderland stories. He was a mathematics professor at Oxford, but his hobby was photography. He was a very good photographer. In fact, he did portrait photography and did portraits of some of the leading people in England at the time, and he was really quite in demand. But he also liked to take pictures of little girls. And he liked to take pictures of little girls dressed up in funny costumes or nude. And he took lots of these. Well, people today, when they read about this, what do they automatically assume about Lewis Carroll? Exactly. That's the automatic assumption. I don't think that was true for a moment. There was a completely different mental set about this at the time. For Lewis Carroll, the little nude girl represented purity. Now, we can't do that anymore. We cannot regard a little nude girl that way anymore. Why not? Because our minds have been messed with, right? By Freud and the Freudians and reports on the newspaper, right? And all sorts of things. We have a different mental set. So you can never project backward. Now, to come to the specific point that you raised, Valerie, yes, what you're saying is certainly there. HPB regards certain primitive, nowadays we don't even like to talk about primitive peoples, do we? That's a
primal.
No-no. All sort of
traditional, primal.
Which I sort of object, because I always thought I had a tradition. I thought I always thought I was traditional. but anyway, it's like I think I'm a Native American. I'm an American. I was born here. All right. We react to words. Peoples of a non-technological culture, not a technologically complex culture. She talks about certain primitive peoples. And these would include the Australian Aborigines, it includes some of the peoples of South India, it includes a variety of peoples around. And she speaks of them in terms, in fact, what she says is that they are remnants, they are survivals of the third and fourth root races, hence holdovers, slowly dying out and disappearing. How she evaluated this, I don't know. What she thought about what she just, those words, those facts, which I have just stated in that way, I don't really know, because I don't have any insight into her mind in that sense. But I would caution you that however she might have thought about them, we should remember that that was the climate of thinking of the time. And you really can't expect a person, for the most part, to think outside the framework of thought of their time. You and I do not think out of the framework of our times. However unconventional we may consider ourselves, however liberated we may consider ourselves, we in fact are bound by the dominant thought patterns of our time, right? We really are. It's inescapable. And the only salvation is to recognize it, right? That's the one way one copes with it, is to recognize it. But you can't escape from it. That's the way it is. However, the way I regard what she said is this. Analogy. Within a family, the children of a particular generation may have certain features, physical features, bodily features, behavioral features perhaps, right? Patterns of action, of behavior, which are survivals of past generations. Parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, any of you ever experienced this where a little child, oh, that's just the way, you know, grandma used to do it, right? There are certain characteristics which pop up later. I think maybe that's true not simply of individuals within is the word I want, ontogeny or a phylogeny? I always forget, ontogeny, right? Not within an ontogeny, within a family. Maybe that's true then of whole groups of people, right? With whole communities, with whole genetic pools within the whole human family. That certain past behavior patterns, characteristics, will pop up in a given pool and be preserved. I myself am absolutely convinced, and I think from what is said in the Secret Doctrine, it is quite clear to me that it has to be the case that all human beings now living upon the face of the earth are really fifth root race. That's all there is left. That's all there is. And we're all the same. We're all of the same stock. And God knows that's the basic principle of the Theosophical Society. The first object of the society is to form a nucleus of the universal human family. We are not forming the human family. The human family exists. It's a fact in nature. The purpose of society is just to form a little nucleus within that. So it seems to me even, and I won't go into all this, but from some of the things that are said in the sacred doctrine, it seems to me quite clear that the fifth root race is Homo sapiens. That's modern humanity. And we're all Homo sapiens, and we're all fifth race. But just in spite of the fact that we're all fifth root race, there can be certain differences in the pools, because we're not, as we're one pool in a sense, in that we're one species, but within that pool, there are little genetic pools, are there not? Isn't that, that's right, isn't it? Yeah, otherwise, we wouldn't have fair-skinned blonde people from the northern climates and dark people from the southern ones, right? Local pools are formed. Within some of these local pools, there may be characteristics, whether they are physical or behavioral or emotional or mental or whatever, that come from really quite ancient times, that represent survivals in some sense of those ancient characteristics. That's the way I interpret what she's talking about, that there are sub-pools within our present humanity which reflect older patterns. Now, what are the practical implications of this fact? Well, that's another matter altogether, right? That depends on how one evaluates it. In my view, the practical implications of that are, well, isn't that interesting? There are local variations, right, in the pools. Yeah, okay, that's, you've got brown eyes.
Blue
eyes. See, my wife always tells me I'm colorblind. Some of us got brown eyes, some of us got blue eyes. That's the way it is, right? Those are variations.
How quaint.
That's nice. On the other hand, it is possible to say, but these people represent not quite really human beings, and so they can be exploited in various ways. And that implication has, of course, been drawn, not by any theosophist, but by other people. So that in Nazi Germany, in the 1920s and on into the 1930s, that was precisely the kind of conclusion that was drawn. Nazi theorists were very much interested in all sorts of things, interested in what philologists were doing at the time. They borrowed a lot of philological concepts. Philological people study languages and ancient cultures. They were interested in the esotericists and what they were doing. They draw a lot from them. And they took all of these things and they perverted them, right, to their own particular purposes. And so, yeah, that is capable of a kind of perversion. A kind of misuse, but so is everything. Everything which is capable of a kind of misuse, and it isn't hard to find examples of that.
Was the secret doctrine itself referenced by the Nazis as one of the source to justify what they were doing?
No, not explicitly. But there were people in Germany in the 20s and 30s who were familiar with the secret doctrine and with that whole other varieties of activity and thought forms and teachings and practices that were associated.
I guess part of what bothered me was in one place she mentions that these people were the later arrivals in the fifth race, and the implication was that they were the less evolved people. Mm-hmm. And my opinion of these people nowadays is that they are the ones that I would consider amongst the most mature of humanity, mm-hmm. in terms of not doing harm to their fellow mm-hmm. human mm-hmm. and living in harmony mm-hmm. with nature. Mm-hmm. And there was an incongruity
right.
there that
right.
I was having trouble with.
Yeah, well, we'd have to look at the actual passages you're thinking of here, because I must admit now I cannot think of a passage which associates these third and fourth root race survivals in the general gene pool with less evolved souls. There may be. One thing you must also keep in mind about this, though, is that a central point of the secret doctrine, and this comes out quite clearly in the conclusion, you know, to the second volume, print this little book, is that the past, and indeed the distant past, had a wisdom which the present has lost. That's a fundamental theme that keeps running through the book, that the ancients knew more about what was really important than we do. We have, in a sense, forgotten what's most important in life, and they knew. So that would go along with what you're saying, and hence really wouldn't be inconsistent with the notion that there are subgenetic pools that somehow preserve some of the characteristics of pre-Homo sapiens.
There is a passage on page 224. What she's actually saying, though, essentially there, is that the admixture of races is making for a stronger
yes.
new race.
Yeah.
So she's
absolutely.
Not advocating any sort of
pure, no. Right.
Same with Nietzsche.
She's not so naive.
Right. Nietzsche was very, who often again gets put in the position of being the inspiration of the National Socialism. He, all through his work, is a clear sense that the mixture of the races and the cultures is to the advantage.
Yeah, actually, in second generation theosophy points within the Americas to the United States and to Brazil as the two central places where the sixth sub-race is being developed. And of course, those are the two places where you get the strongest admixture of cultures. I mean, Brazil has strong African, strong Native American, in addition to the Portuguese and other kinds of admixtures.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that gets me about all this stuff about the races is a lot of it just doesn't even make sense physically. I mean, you've talked a lot about metaphorical, and all these early races, I mean, some of them aren't even supposed
right.
to be physical.
Right.
So I wonder, when she's talking about races in the modern world, if it really makes sense to talk about physical races as opposed to just their cultures,
right.
which is what's made.
Sure. Yeah, we've talked about that. The term race here is a terrible one. It's very inappropriate because of all of the associations we've got with the term, because of the way we usually use it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she talked about, again, three strands of evolution which are interwoven. One is the evolution of matter and of physical forms. But here, well, what she's talking about the evolution is eventually the etherealization of matter and of physical forms in the future. And then the second strand is the evolution of consciousness or intellect, or we would say, I think, culture. And then the third strand is the evolution of the spirit, of spiritual awareness, which is quite different from intellect or culture.
She never mentions nutrition. You know, they say that certain parts of the world, just because of what they eat, they live to be 100, 105, 110 years old. She died when she was 59 years old, when in those times that was old. In these times that's, you know, not so old. So you're saying like the Essenes, when they chose Mary to be the mother of Jesus, you know, they fed her various things to, you know, make her healthy and so-called and all that. And so was Jesus raised in that particular cell. But she doesn't mention anything of that nature in the races or the races. You talked about certain things in families. Well, there's, you know, one child is retarded and another one's a genius, you know. Like right now they're finding out fluoride and whether it was poisonous and it gives you cancer, and yet everybody's still drinking Chicago water. You know, so we go on and on and on like that. We're talking about increasing our, or the races, but there's nothing that she mentions as far as food is concerned.
HPB was not, in fact, much interested in physical matters, in that physical line of evolution, which is not to say it's not important. It's just not everybody can be interested in everything. And she simply wasn't much interested in things like that. Example, everybody who knew her personally used to comment on her style of dress. HPB favored sort of long flowing garments that, not stylish garments, They were house dresses of the late 19th century. They were.
Wasn't she a chain smoker?
And she, yeah. Well, I don't know if she was a chain smoker a lot. She certainly smoked very heavily, as everybody else did around her. She wasn't concerned with physical matters of that sort. Her attention was focused somewhere else, which is not to say that the physical is not important. I happen to think it's very important. But that just wasn't her concern. So no, you're right. She never, as far as I know, she never, hardly ever talked about diet. Well, actually, she did. She talked about vegetarian. She was not herself always a vegetarian. She was a vegetarian part of, when she was in India, largely she was a vegetarian. And even when she left India, she was more or less vegetarian. But she was not complete vegetarian. The only thing she really talked about a lot was alcohol, which she disapproved of thoroughly. She thought it was bad stuff, particularly brandy. I suspect that HPB would have agreed with Jesus. It is not that which goeth into the mouth of a man that defileth him, but that which cometh out therefrom. I don't know that that answers the point you raised, but it's. I said in respect to it, I think that with any of those problems, you have to remember there's a difference in sensibility, and you always have to keep that in mind, and not project our sensibilities back on them. And the other thing is, we have to look at what seem to be the facts and say, well, what do these facts mean to us, right? Which may or may not have been what it meant to them. Because our sensibilities cause our focus to be different.
And I think most of the language allows for a very smooth kind of projection of our way of thinking onto it. I think it's rarely that you have something that stands out that is discomforting. For the most part, I think the sense of unity, of oneness, the sense of the process going on is one of respect for all beings over and over again. So it's not a... You know, it's not a projection onto something like a Rorschach blot here. I think there's an awful lot that's right in the text and the total philosophy that allows you to have a sense of respect, equality, that we would want.
Yeah, and we must keep in mind that part of this... The vision in the stanzas is one of continuous progress of all living forms, of everything being alive, of everything being instinct with life, and of that life in whatever form it's expressed, constantly evolving and changing in a progressive manner to higher expressions. And indeed, today there have been within the history of our planet those souls who are referred to as laggards. But let's remember that we were laggards once. this is relative, and that those who are laggards at this time will be in advance in the future, because there's simply a progressive development. With people at different stages. And laggard happens to be a pejorative term, right? But they're just people at different stages, and they're all moving, right? Not necessarily all at the same speed, but each one at whatever speed is appropriate.
And I think what we were talking about last time, again, that's where the tolerance comes in, is the grasping of that. is that we have a sense again of the different stages different people are at, different beings are at. And there's no need to interfere with that. Our sphere is our own inner development.
In here you said that you would be addressing spiritual intuition and different things like that. In the particular book, is it discussed things to study, things of that nature, to become more spiritual, and how to use it for good?
That the implication is that's what this whole process of development, of evolution, of change is about.
It's more about the whole just evolution of man as a whole.
Yeah, if you're looking for something on personal development, there are probably other books that are better for that. Sure.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's a good point, just in terms of your review, the first session when we were talking, it was bringing up Marie-Louise von Franz's notion that the role of creation myth is one of which it provides a basis for development. It is a basis for one to feel some sense of security and direction. And I think what's very interesting, of course, about this myth is its universality in terms of the planet and even beyond the planet. So it's a very unusual myth that unfolds here, which is one, again, I think that does prepare one to embrace the universe in a certain way, unlike others. And von Franz, one of the things that she mentioned in particular about where myth allows humanity to evolve is in the playfulness that it provides. There's a sense in which she suggests that when we get uptight, when we get too rigid in terms of particularly the mental dimensions, is that anything that can loosen that up, anything to get us, not take it as seriously, is the precondition from which new forms can develop. And I think, again, this myth is one in which there are many new forms. In fact, John told me if I would do this only in a humorous way, here's the book for you all now. Now, this is the third volume, Theogenesis, which goes beyond cosmogenesis and anthropogenesis, by the Temple of the People, which is a spin-off from 1898, of the TS. This was a couple groups in New York that were in the American section, as you know, some of the split-offs. They went off and moved to what became Halcyon, California, and they have another version of stanzas that complete the next stage of the development, namely, how do we go from the anthropogenic stage to our next higher development? And so again, I urge you to, this is in the reference section, in the Theosophical reference section.
Invite them, don't urge them.
Okay, what was it? Invite. Boy, picky with this language stuff. But anyway, to at least take a look at some vision of it, because of course you're going to see some very obvious differences in terms of just the linguistic style and the direction of the visions and metaphors. But it just seems to me, again, what I think in the playful sense is, we're not finished now. And in our sense, where are we going individually or as a people as we come into this big dramatic next few days, really, right? What do we got, 15 days left, 16 days left?
Before the end of the world, right?
Well, I don't know about that. But anyway, I think the playfulness, the part of it is a really good one to keep in mind. This was something that brought a sort of a security to the people, as well as, in a sense, a subtle kind of stimulus to do different and to be different as well.
Yeah, that's a very good point Tony made, and I should have made it, actually. I'm glad he did. In the book we've been looking at, there's nothing like a 12-step program, right, for becoming spiritual. It's not there. But A basic notion in this book, as in all theosophical thinking, is that there are analogies between everything. That all things are analogies. There are only certain basic patterns of thought and behavior, and they keep repeating themselves on different levels for different purposes. And so this great story of cosmic evolution, which is what this book is about, does in fact have an analogy to the individual development of the person, because it mirrors that great cosmic process. And so that in a sense, it is a kind of book of directions, only not 12 steps. You have to write your own 12 steps out of it. But Tony and I each have something we sort of like to say, sort of in summary, on these stances. Let me go first, then we'll let Tony have the last word. The stanzas, the book ends with a kind of poetic apostrophe to time and eternity. And that is curiously appropriate to the beginning of the book. Because you remember the first stanza that we have been, of this whole series we've been looking at, begins, "The eternal parent wrapped in her ever invisible robes had slumbered once again for 7 eternities. Time was not, for it lay asleep in the infinite bosom of duration." Right? And then the book ends with these words. "Before thou hast begun to say, I am the progeny of the departed moment, the child of the past, thou hast become that past thyself. Before thou utterest the last syllable, behold, thou art no more the present, but verily that future. Thus are the past, the present, and the future, the ever-living trinity in one, the great illusion of the absolute is. Time was not, for it lay asleep in the infinite bosom of duration." We've come, as it were, full circle.
Mm-hmm. And actually, in Ola Nu, it says, "In the beginning, which is also the end, there was the long night of rest." And once again, it seems to me, what is the kind of attitudinal valence that comes through a myth is a very important thing. And it seems to me, again, that there's the sense of whatever has gone on specifically, in the sense of empiricism, of science, that which can be renewed by each generation with new observations and new data. Whatever has happened in the past with all its complexities, the question I think again is the attitude of yay or nay. I mean, this is to me a very much a strong yes to life, yes to the whole future, yes to that which we bequeath to the next generations. And as it ends in the epilogue of Ola Nu, "Behold, Ola Nu, you are a 7-aspected being, a collection of atoms and molecules and subtle energies which are constantly changing, evolving, becoming, in a universe which is constantly changing, evolving, becoming. You have become today that which you were becoming yesterday. So cling not to that which was, but look at what is to be, at what you are becoming. For to resist this forward motion is to resist the very nature of the universe. And as you move toward a spiritual destiny, glorious beyond your imagination, know that we are all pilgrim souls at different stages of the same journey. And be not deluded into saying thy soul and my soul, for at the end of the journey we will be as one. The path is long, but be not overawed, nor feel insignificant or alone. For whatever stage you have reached, like all pilgrim souls, you can do no more than take the next step. And with every step, know that you are truly sacred, and that all sentient beings are your kin. For you are part of God, and God is all of you." Not a bad way of looking at what is, without a question, challenging future. It's not something that's, again, for the weak of will. the weak, I mean, those who are weak and well, because it's going to be challenging. There's no question about it. It's not an automatic, but yet, I think, again, it asks us to mobilize the best within us at all times for the whatever comes our way. So in this case, then, I think it seems to me that myth is not escapism, it's not illusion, but it's an opportunity to really examine the deeper parts of our being. And to, you know, I think with that fuller understanding, face life in all of its challenges.